Paul Selig is one of my favorite guests, and he comes on today to channel the wisdom that comes through a group of beings he calls the guides. And of course, I approach all channelings with a degree of skepticism, but time and again, the guides provide wisdom and clarity that resonates as true within my own body. And this podcast was no exception, perhaps one of my favorite conversations I've ever had with Paul. So it is with absolute delight that I share this podcast with Paul Selig and the guides. I hope you guys enjoy it. And now a word from our sponsors. First up, we have Helix. And the reason why I'm continuing to have Helix as an advertiser on the podcast is because I'm continuing to sleep on Helix mattresses. Oftentimes, wherever I go, if I'm going to stay in there for long enough, I'll send a Helix mattress over there because I really approve and appreciate the sleep that I get on a Helix mattress, the many choices that they offer, and also the way that when you pull that mattress out of all the packaging, it doesn't smell like those toxic mattresses that you could get from those traditional stores, which are soon becoming dinosaurs because there's just a better model. And Helix has that better model. It has a better mattress. So I get homies who talk to me. Maybe they've heard a read on the podcast, or maybe they're just curious because I wrote a book that includes conversations about sleep. And not that I'm an expert on all things sleep personally, but I do understand the field in a great way. And I do understand what a great mattress is and what I like and what my family likes. And so I unequivocally recommend Helix as the mattress, just straight up. It's what I believe the best in class. I think the pricing is super competitive and really reasonable. The way that they create the mattress, the whole thing top to bottom from a company and from a product standpoint are just top of class. So if you're interested in purchasing that next mattress, or you have a guest bedroom, or you got that mattress and you're like, man, I'm not going to tell my guests that their mattress there is kind of shit, but whatever, you know, they love me and it's all good. Maybe think about upgrading to a Helix mattress, even for your guest room or wherever else you might be sleeping. So if you're interested, go to helixsleep.com/AMP and you are getting 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows using the URL helixsleep.com/AMP. And this is the best offer we've ever had. And so with Helix, you're going to have better sleep. I really believe that. And that can start now with this really incredible offer from Helix. So once again, helixsleep.com/AMP for 20% off your mattress orders and two free pillows. Next up, we have Mudwater. Now, you guys have probably heard me talk about Mudwater for the past few years. And recently, I actually got to meet in person the founder, Shane Heath, an amazing human being who makes an amazing product that I still use all the time. Now, how do I use it? Well, Mudwater's a coffee alternative. It has a bit of the caffeine that comes from the tea, but it also has a bunch of functional mushrooms and a bunch of different other goodies like cacao and all these delicious things, without all of the sweeteners that you find in a lot of these different mixes as well. So what I do in the morning is I put in a little ghee, I put in a little cashew butter, I sprinkle in some Mudwater, I add my favorite protein, I blend it up, and it has become the famous Aubrey morning drink. And they also have non-caffeinated versions, which has become the famous Aubrey evening drink. Mudwater is a part of my life, and it's a part of my life for good reason. It's just a great product. It's Whole30 approved, 100% USDA certified organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, vegan, kosher, and it's awesome. And also, Mudwater donates monthly to support psychedelic research, and it has since day one. Mudwater's our people, and Mudwater's a drink that I love, and it follows me around everywhere, along with their cool little frother blender thing when I don't have a blender available. And you can get that along with samples of their coconut creamer and sweetener if you go to mudwater.com/AMP. Now you spell that mudwtr.com/AMP. Once again, mudwtr.com/AMP. And on that link, you'll get all the samples and your frother for free. So go to mudwater.com/AMP. Now an uninterrupted podcast with Paul Selig. Paul, it's good to see you again, brother.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So as we're exploring this text from largely the Book of Innocents and wherever else it might go, what in your mind is the direction that the guides took the teachings in Book of Innocents that included and transcended the other teachings that they've taught prior?
You know, I don't know. They just finished another one. You know, the 12th book was just completed about 2 weeks ago. And so my brain is sort of swimming from all of this. And there's a point when they all sort of come together as one. I think what's really happened in the teachings is they've taken us away from a kind of sense of self-importance to a sense of collective awareness. And a lot of what they're working with now is this idea of moving beyond collective restriction. And most of these things seem to be held in memory. So where they went to in this book, which was very different and unexpected, was that the idea that everything that we see and experience in most ways has been named by those who came before us. And every memory mm-hmm. that we hold individually and collectively is tainted by what they say is a false belief in separation. So our memory is actually faulty, and they're dealing with a restoration to the aspect of each of us that they say is innocence, is the true innocent, and not innocent as in stupid, but innocent as in uncorrupted, untainted, known without fear. So they've said for a long time that the octave, the common field that we all share and occupy, is informed by fear in such a way that we don't even really recognize it. It's just present. It's like swimming in a dirty swimming pool. It's all we've known, so we just don't know the difference. And the idea of moving to what they call the upper room and reclaiming ourselves, or being reclaimed might be a better way to say it, at this level of tone or resonance claims a world anew, because the world that we see isn't informed by the old, and consequently can be lifted or reclaimed at this level of tone or resonance, which does not hold the old template. So if you can imagine just shifting beyond a whole system of agreement and what things were supposed to mean, who we're supposed to be, and how we thought the world was, to a very different way, I think that's where they're taking us now.
Yeah, really. What I feel when I'm reading the words from the guides and just feeling it in my own body. And that's one of the reasons why we came together, is that what the guides are saying are things that feel true, anthro-ontologically, anthropos, my body, ontologically, that which is real. I feel it in my body.
Yeah.
And this idea that the kingdom is here, but the kingdom is a perception. It's a perception from a different octave. And actually all things are the kingdom, if you can see it from that octave.
Yeah.
And it's the interesting parts are, is then you can't one, deny the divine that is in, mm-hmm. as, and through all things. You can't deny the divine, but you also mm-hmm. can't bypass yeah. the actual strata of density that yeah. things are happening, where yeah. moves are being made, control and fear and all of these different things are being proliferated from. So mm-hmm. it's an interesting place that the guides are inviting. They're inviting us to. Mm-hmm. And I feel this invitation personally, and I feel, you know, incredibly grateful that I've been able to actually find myself on the bridge to be able to see through, you know, the upper room, and then mm-hmm. also take action in the level of density from the sight that I've been able to gain from mm-hmm. the upper room. But it requires us to be able to see all of the different octaves and then be able to navigate what we should do and how we should interact with the world.
I agree. I mean, you know, they said in the very first book, which was dictated in 2009 and published in 2010, and this is the 11th, that humanity is a time of reckoning. And then they broke that down and said a reckoning is a facing of oneself and all of one's creations, and that everything that's been claimed and created in fear needs to be re-seen or reclaimed in a higher way. And I don't think that we get to do that unless we're willing to bear witness to it. You know, it's not about accusation and blame as much as recognition. Because the guides have said again and again and again, you can't lift, where they say you can't lift the evil man to the upper room because you've aligned to him at that level of tone or consciousness or equivalency. But that doesn't deny the acts of one or the collective choices that we've made. I think we like to think that we're not party to what we see because it's happening elsewhere or through somebody else's experience. But the guides have actually said that if you can see it, you're in alignment to it, and the consciousness that you hold is actually informing it at whatever level you come to it with. So if you're coming to it, as you said, from the higher perspective, you can actually lift it or reclaim it at its essence, which is of source. You know, mm-hmm. they say, who you put in darkness, what you put in darkness calls you to the darkness. They've said it for years. And it's a simple teaching, but it's a teaching of alignment. You go to the higher where you're not reinforcing the negative, but you can see what is there and you can understand it and you can also lift it. This doesn't mean you're not in discernment. I think it means you're in high discernment. But I mm-hmm. think the aspect of you that's perceiving is the one that's perceiving without the agenda that the personality structure probably has.
Right. There's a quote from the book, and it's, you cannot fight the darkness. You can bring the light to the darkness, but illumination is never a battle.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful and pure and clean teaching, as always the guides, you know, they deliver with a sense of impeccability. But there's a nuance to that, because in certain cases, the illumination may be resisted,
yeah.
one, resisted, and two, the illumination may be necessary. Mm-hmm. And so this is the interesting spot, because again, yes, it can't be a fight, but mm-hmm. also there's tension between the one who's trying to bring the illumination and the one who is resistant to, because of their agreements to fear, resistant mm-hmm. to the illumination, their agreements to separation, resistant to the illumination. So it does create a certain sense of tension, which could mm-hmm. be perceived as a fight, but I think it's subtle what the guides are saying.
More productive, possibly, too. You know, I mean, if you shine a light on something that's been held in darkness for a very, very long time, first of all, the thing doesn't know what to do. It wants to scamper. I mean, go down to your basement and, you know, look at the little bugs that turn the lights on. They're all scurrying away from the light. And I think nothing is reclaimed until it's first accepted. If the intention is to judge and make wrong, then you have to look at what the motive is. Because I think the idea of illumination is simply, it goes back to this quote of the guides, which threw me for a long time, but I sort of get it now. They said, in truth, a lie cannot be held. So in the vibration of truth, the distortion doesn't exist. At the level of innocence that they're teaching now, which is truth, I guess it's another way to say that, the agendas of the personality self at whatever level have to be reclaimed and renown as well. You know, you don't get, he says, you can't be the light and hold another in darkness. It's really simple. And so the light itself may be challenging and frightening to one who hasn't seen it. You know, they said once in one of the books, maybe this one, that if somebody has been really reared in darkness, I mean, imagine someone who's lived their whole life in shadow and darkness, it's extraordinarily challenging to be called for, to be witnessed in a higher way. You know, when the guides do workshops and they have people work with each other and they're seeing the inherent divinity in the ones before them or the people are doing it with partners, some people can't do it. It's too painful to be seen with love. It's too hard. They haven't known it. And it's amazing when it happens. You know, everything can change very quickly then.
Right. There, what I'm curious about is, I understand the teaching, God is, God is, God is. And then, and even in the unknown and everywhere you look, God is there. There's not a place where you look where God isn't. You know, like that's an aspect of it. Then there are what appear to be forces who are intentionally, and these forces could be embodied or, but I'm particularly interested in the non-embodied versions of these forces, forces that are seeming to be intentionally creating more separation, intentionally creating a denial of the divine, intentionally trying to debase and kind of demoralize our understanding of our truth and corrupt our innocence in a certain way. And
What is, you know, maybe you or the guides, like what are the thoughts about these darker forces that are working against our recognition of who we really are, what we are, how we serve? Because there is an antagonist, seemingly antagonistic force. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there's also another way that you could look at it from the highest perspective, where mm-hmm. the darkness serves the light. Mm-hmm. But there are forces that are trying to corrupt our innocence and push us further into separation and deny mm-hmm. the divine that are out there that seem both incarnate and also mm-hmm. outside of incarnated presence.
Well, they don't talk about other forces. They do talk about the action of fear, and they talk about fear as a strata vibration, which I assume would be encompassing of this. When they say the action of fear is to claim more fear, which is what they've always said, they're speaking to this. Fear seeks to replicate itself like a cancer, you know, and mm-hmm. every choice any one of us makes in fear, they say will get us more of the same. And at the collective level, when we're all invited to be in fear, then you have the residual affect of that at a very large scale. I understand something that I didn't about this. They said finally, you know, they said fear isn't wise. Fear doesn't really transcend. Fear is actually kind of can't go past its own baseline. It's not, it's clever, perhaps, but it's not wise, you know. And so you move to a level where you're no longer choosing and aligning from that. Does that mean it's no longer there? I don't know that it means that it's no longer there. I think it stops becoming active. Like anything else. I mean, I, you know, stopped drinking when I was 25. I think it would be a bad idea if I started again. But I'm no longer activating an addiction mm-hmm. by not imbibing, you know, the thing that's going to take me down that road. So I'll ask the guides about this. But where I get cautious is that people sometimes like to dine out on the dark stuff because it's sexy, you know, and it's dramatic. And I don't know that that necessarily gets us a lot back, because the idea of being a warrior concerns me sometimes, because a warrior needs a battle and needs a war.
Right.
And I think that things can be transformed in other ways. I'm not negating the fact that people take action at different levels and at different times, different kinds of action are required and necessary, you know? So let me go to them quickly.
Before you do, I just want to comment on this fear, because I had a very profound revelation that's right in alignment with that. And I was doing ayahuasca recently, mm-hmm. and in the ayahuasca journey, of course, you know, this is a big part of my path, mm-hmm. the plant medicine path, and that's my way to be able to connect. Mm-hmm. And I actually encountered the entity of fear. Mm-hmm. The kind of this amorphous entity of fear. It was capital F fear itself. Mm-hmm. And I could feel fear trying to scare me as mm-hmm. a recruitment tactic to get me to join it. It was like a conversion. It was like the fear Jehovah's Witness, you know, like, let me get you afraid so you can join in my fear. And I had to stand, and it was showing me lots of scary things, like as much as clever as it could to show me things to get me to be afraid. And I just looked at fear, eyes, you know, my third mm-hmm. eye, of course, my eyes are closed, but third eye unblinking, and said, I'm not afraid. Like, I will not join you. And it was a very powerful moment. And I think that speaks to this fear energy. And I have a visceral understanding. Again, I know that in my body now, and everything that the guides have been saying about fear mm-hmm. seeks to replicate itself. Fear mm-hmm. wants to claim more fear. It was trying to actually convert me. It was like trying mm-hmm. to convert me to the religion of fear, mm-hmm. you know, in my body to get me to be afraid so I could join it. And so I understand that. And then what I'm curious about, though, and this is the point for the guides mm-hmm. is, and I'm not saying that the logical conclusion of this curiosity is that the warrior must come in and fight it, but there's seems to be something beyond fear, which is intentional malice.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm curious about.
Oh, that's when they've taken on the subject of evil, that's how they've described it. Pretty much. It's the intent to do harm. It is the intent. Now, the challenging thing is, for me, is they say all things are of God, but they're operating at different levels of tone. And they talk about octaves. And the lowest octave is still part of the whole, but it's just having a different expression. And that doesn't mean that it's a good thing. It just means that you can't, I don't know that you can separate it or excise it. You have to reclaim it and lift it, you know, and it's a challenging thing for me. But let me go and see if they want to jump in on this in some way. And,
you okay,
know,
great.
But haven't heard me, you know, I whisper and repeat, and it's awkward as can be, but it's how it happens. They're saying the idea of fear is what needs to be addressed, and the idea of who you think you are, and the idea of who you think you are emblazoned by fear. Emblazoned by fear is what is being addressed. Now, is what is being addressed now at a mutual level, at a communal level, at a large level, the truth of who you are, the truth of who you are, the divine self. If you're sure the divine self, if you wish, is not abiding in fear, does not abide in fear. And in fact, the upper room, is not a place of fear, is not a place of fear. The tone cannot be played here. Your experience in the common field, of what you know of is fear, is actually a collective room, is actually a collective agreement that can we move on, that can and will be moved beyond when you see the truth of it, when you see the futility of it. If you look at this as a battle. If you look at this as a battle to be fighting forever, you will be fighting forever. If you look at it as a low strata of choice and vibration, you can remedy it. You can remedy it or align it to the higher or align it to the higher. Now, when the light shines upon the darkness, the need for the darkness may be understood. When you stop requiring it, stop requiring to be the winner at the cost of losing, at the cost of somebody losing, you may transcend even the idea of war, the action of fear, yes. To create more fear, to create more fear is understood, but you're all participatory to this. And when you look at this as a villain seeking to convert you to fear, you actually empower it even more. It's an idea that has taken shape, and the idea of fear, is finally all you grapple with, when the idea of fear is released. Enacting it is released as well. And that is what you're on the cusp of. Period. And they're saying period.
I'm in full alignment to that. And and with all respect to our, to the guides and their wisdom and their brilliance and you, I still feel a little bit unresolved with their being. Intentional malice does not necessarily, in my understanding, require fear, because you could intend malice from a place not that it's afraid, because there's one way that I'm afraid, let me go take this from you because I'm afraid, or I'm afraid, let me go kill you because I'm afraid. And I get that. Yeah. I'm talking about a different, which is like, I'm not afraid, and I'm not using me personally, but I'm just saying like a being, I'm not afraid. I'm just trying to fuck this thing up intentionally, you know, and it can be, so the evil that's devoid of fear.
They haven't talked about that, but what they say is that the only problem that humanity really has is what they call the denial of the divine. And that would be an example of that. That's it. But that's our creation, they say. That's our responsibility. Now, do I think that there are like parasitic energies that we can get attached to and screw with us? Yeah, I do. You know, they're not nice. They're low-level things, and I think they need to be reclaimed in a higher way. It's a hard one for me. You know, I'm the child of a Holocaust survivor. My father was in the Kinder transport and sent to England. I mean, there are things that I can't rationalize, kinds of cruelty that we enforce upon each other. And what's even harder for me to understand is that we're all oddly party to these things, you know, the collective agreement to what we've accepted and what is acceptable must be understood as something that we're complicit with. So let me go back to the guys on the action of fear as sort of, or the action of cruelty or malice.
And malice, yeah.
See if they want to say this. The intention to harm is always the action of fear, whether or not you give it another name. All the idea of sin is, if you wish to use that term, is the denial of the divine. cruelty itself is an enactment of fear. It's the aggression of fear. It's the aggression of fear, or seeking to become fearful, or seeking to become fearful, or to be as harmed, or to be as harmed. On the other hand, the denial of the divine can be understood in many ways. The aspect of you knows who he is, who knows who he is, the true self we wish. The true self, if you wish, is not capable of that. It would not induce the suffering of another through its intention. The low level of alignment. The low level of alignment that you're all party to, that you are all party to, presents this as an opportunity, and it's a disfigurement in some ways of your true natures. The truth of innocence is that the truth of you is that the truth of you is actually loved and is in love and is in love. The distortions you speak to, which can become empowered or fueled by hatred, which is also born in fear, the negation of the divine must be understood as a creation of humanity, that you are moving beyond, and you must do this to maintain the species, period, and they're saying period. Mm.
Yeah, that makes more sense, because then it's, okay, there's two buckets. One is fear, and mm-hmm. one is the denial of the divine.
Yeah.
And either way, one or both of those are in action when mm-hmm. you see something like malice cool. actually out in the world. It's the denial of the divine and fear, and that makes a lot of sense, because I don't have it exactly... here, but I know I have a quote from you in front of me in one of these many quotes that I pulled, but, you know, fundamentally the idea that if you are in the upper room, you would never actually harm anybody because you see yourself as connected to the source field. You see yourself and everybody else as another mm-hmm. expression of life, yeah. you know, and so as you see yourself as a part of life, there is no pleasure in harming another because you realize that you're harming yourself. So it can't really work. It's necessary to be in the delusion of the myth of separation.
And it's seductive, you know? I mean, it's seductive. The desire to be special, the desire to maintain a sense of separation, the desire to win at the cost of somebody losing. Now, the guides have said self-righteousness is always the small self. It's always the personality self. Because the true self or the divine self isn't in that game. It mm-hmm. doesn't have an axe to grind in the same way. But it's a challenge, I know. It's a challenge for me. But I do know that for me, the level of fear that I used to live in is not present. You know, things are still tainted by it, I suspect. But I'm not, you know, the kid that I was in a lot yeah. of ways. I've grown through that, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. I've also, since the last time we spoke, I've had some profound psychonautic experiences. Mm-hmm. I mentioned one vignette from an ayahuasca journey, uh-huh. but one of the passages that you have in the book really reminded me of a very distinct moment that I had. And so I'm going to read the passage. On this day, I choose to allow the manifest divine, the truth of who I really am, to claim me in fullness, imparting its wisdom, imparting its joy, its awareness of source, to be my teacher, to be my ally, to be my expression, fullness of being. As I say yes to this, I allow this merging. As I say yes to this, I agree to this manifestation. As I say yes to this, I say yes to God as all that is and can be. I am word through this intention, word I am word. So in that, there was a very profound moment where I have distinct contact with what I would call my soul. Mm-hmm. It seems to have a star origin, and I want to get into that as well because mm-hmm. it's part of my own cosmology. I could call mm-hmm. it my star self or my soul. Mm-hmm. It's almost like an oversoul where Aubrey mm-hmm. is just one of the lives that this oversoul has lived. And I felt that soul come in and say to me, Aubrey, say, I'm coming in. And I go, okay. And it goes, are you sure? You're like, are you sure you want me to come in? And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. And it's like, it asked like three times. It was like, are you really sure that you want me to come in? And I was like, yeah, I'm really sure. And it's been a time of, you know, some difficulty for me in this stretch. And that force kind of came in and it gave me a deep sense of peace. And it also was able to really disentangle me from fear and allow me to navigate and see things from a very like almost white light clarity. But it was very precise. And it didn't have the kind of warmth that the Aubrey does. Aubrey has a very golden light energy, like I'm very warm. And this was much like, nope, this is how it is. It was no denial of the divine, absolutely not. No badness, but it was very, very efficient. It was like very efficient. This is what needs to happen. This is what you do. And it was very interesting how that force has been stronger and stronger in me. And it seems like I've been able to merge that with myself in a greater way. And it's now kind of always present, but I'm also able to still drop back into the Aubrey and get in all my feels too.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of ways what the guides are teaching. I mean, the experience that you're describing is comparable. I've had, when I was younger, when I was in my maybe early 30s and I was first starting to channel, I used to feel like I had a tin can up to my ear on a string and I would just hope somebody would talk into the other tin can because I was really worried people would gather and I wouldn't be able to hear. And I was a wreck about this almost every week because I didn't understand any of how it worked. And then eventually one day they said before a group, do we have permission to merge? And it was a very similar experience. And from then on, it's just like turning a dial to that other voice. You know, it's not like I have to reach elsewhere. And when the guides step into me and they work, you know, and they work one-on-one with people at times, you know, it's extraordinary. The feeling is extraordinary. And there is deep compassion and deep love and a kind of neutrality, I think.
The neutrality, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what's interesting about it.
It's really interesting. And it's divine neutral is, you know, what I call it. You know, it's neither good nor bad. It just is, you know, it just is. And it is without the old agenda. And it is without my personality chiming in and saying, you better be careful what you do or say or how it's seen or all those things. It just is. And it's an extraordinary experience. They say, and that's really what they're teaching now, I think in the Book of Innocence and the one they just completed, is how that's maintained, how you operate at that level. And because, and as you said, it doesn't come at the cost of what you enjoy or who you spend your time with. What you love. But they said, you know, that one of the very first things they ever said to me, and I might have told this to you before years ago, when I was very young and just opening up and very confused by it all, I heard freedom will come when the throne relinquishes its king. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? But it basically is who's running the show, who sits in the throne. And they said the personality has its place, but our confusion is we think it's the king.
Yeah.
We think the goat structure is running everything and it need not. So I think what you're talking about is just what they're speaking to.
Yeah. It's almost like it's almost a hollowing out experience I've had. It's like a hollowing out. And then, but I still have the full, you know, the full costume of the personality self that I, and it's always with me and it's always one, you know, one just little shift away and I can step fully into the, and the beautiful parts of it are always there as well. But it's like, there's a hollowing out of my attachment to that as being who I am. And it's been a really beautiful process, but also created a lot of massive kind of disruption in relationships and everything in my life as well, because it's a different thing. I'm not the same person that I exactly thought I was. You know, I'm something that includes and transcends that person.
Yeah, I get it. You know, I get it. In the book that they just dictated, they actually use the metaphor a lot of becoming like a flute or an instrument that's being hollowed out so that God or source can play through it, you know, and that's really what the work is, I think. You know, they don't talk about it as the work. I think of it as the work. Mm-hmm. But in an earlier book, you know, they brought everybody to the upper room and they said, the claim is, I have come, I have come, I have come. And they said, it's the divine self or the monad that announces this. What they also said was get ready for the shit to fly, because basically yeah, every aspect of you that's been held in darkness or we want to repress or suppress needs to be re-known and re-seen and reclaimed. And reclamation is really the key. You can call it redemption if you want, although that's a word that's been, I think, misappropriated in some ways. But they say the divine self or the true self or the Christed self, whatever you want to call it, is capable of reclaiming all of this and will, you know. And as you said early on when you were asked, you know, is this okay or can I merge, about the merging, that I understand too is essential, because I think we do have free will. And, you know, the guides always ask, you know, they don't override free will. They really don't. They respect it. I've often said, you know, if I want to walk into traffic, they're going to let me. If I say, is this a good time to cross the street? They might say, not wise. Not wise. If you want to kill yourself, you can, but it's really not going to be what you want. And I trust that now.
This is, so this brings up a very important point where I feel a little stuck. And so where I feel a little stuck is I felt my faith in the divine growing exponentially. I see signs everywhere. I feel the divine with me. I hear the whispers, not in the same way that you do, you know, but I hear them in my body. I hear them somatically, and ideas and thoughts and a knowing of things. And then I also have a deep respect and recognition for free will and the choices that people can make. So oftentimes I will have a deep sense of, oh, this is the possibility that's being presented. And then I will witness somebody make a choice to close down that possibility. And I see that in the smaller scale, in the micro, but I also recognize that in the macro. And so it starts to affect my faith in a certain way, because I'm like, well, God, I understand. I understand what your desire is. And I have faith in you so much. And I also know that you're granting free will. So where my faith starts to lapse is, I guess it's faith in people to choose the higher octave expression. And so that's where my faith gets challenged. So when I'm like, do you have faith in the world? Yes, I have, because I have faith in God. But then I sometimes go, well, fuck, but how much faith do I have in people to be willing to choose the action of the divine moving through them?
Well, I understand everything that you're saying. I have given up on trying to tell people what to do. You know, I really don't. I'm not interested. And the guides don't tell people what to do either. They offer choice and we can take them. They talk a lot about will in their work. And they talk about it as a braiding of the will. You know, we're coming from, some of us perhaps, I mean, I was raised sort of an atheist, but this idea of thy will, not mine be done, as if there are polarities here. And I think where they're taking us is to a unified will, or the divine self or the true self comprehends the needs of the small, and the two wills sort of braid. And I understand that the higher will begins to claim itself in fullness, but not at the cost of the old. It's a respect, I think, of the individual. It's not about abandoning self. It's about allowing self to be known and to be met. So the question then is, how does the world change if nobody wants to choose the higher? Now, what the guides teach now, which is challenging as hell, you know, and I'm understanding it because it's where they've been going throughout all the books, and I just didn't really know where they were going, is moving to a level of alignment where you become, in some ways, a transistor or a broadcast of the higher. And entrainment or vibrational accord is what begins to alter what you encounter. They talk about the title of the book, the 12th book, which is the last of these teachings, I understand. There's other stuff they want to talk about later, is a world made new. And they're really talking about how this occurs at the level of the individual and the collective. And it's an enormous transition and a very ungraceful one, I think, because we're so moored into what we've known. But they say when a seed sprouts from the earth, you know, it moves the earth around it. There's always disruption. So I'm going to go to your question with them if I can and see if they want to. How do you address the lack of high choice choosing mm-hmm. for yourself. Well, you're choosing for yourself and how you embody, and how you embody actually elicits a comparable response, actually elicits a comparable response, even response resistance, even if the response is resistance from those you encounter, from those you encounter when you are becoming light. When you are becoming the light, you are shining upon that which no one is shining upon. You are shining upon that which does not want, wish to be shined on. It will revolt, and it will revolt, and then remedy itself, and then remedy itself, because finally it understands, because finally it understands that the way forward, that the way forward is not back into the darkness, is not back into the darkness, even though they've been trained to it, even though they have been entrained to it. Now what you're discovering, is going to do what you want, or is that people aren't going to do what you want, and release the outcome, and you release the outcome, or the idea that they should, or the idea that they should, you will find less resistance. You will find less resistance. In fact, the ways are being paved. In fact, the ways are being paved for all humanity, in different paths, perhaps, and different paths, perhaps, to align to a higher template, The higher template is the upper room. The higher template is the upper room, or for the octave, or if you prefer, the octave above the one you've known, above the one you have known. There are things that don't exist there, and there are things that do not exist there, ways of expressing, or ways of expressing through hatred and fear, that are not aligned, and will disperse, This will take several generations. To manifest fully, but the ongoing process is present. People are waking up. You're experiencing resistance. Some do not want to get out of bed. They need to be tossed out of it. Level, and it is soul level. They will incur that. When it's required.
Yeah, I think that. I think that piece of guidance that I'm getting from that is to release the expectation of outcome, even if I can feel that there is a higher choice available. There's a feast being served in the upper room. And I'm like, y'all, if y'all just climb the stairs, there's a whole feast and you're eating scraps down here in the living room, you know, and it's like, come on, let's go, upper room, come on, you know, but it's also like that kind of desire and expectation may prevent them from wanting to just walk up to the upper room on their own accord.
People don't trust that they have a right to go there, and they don't want to be disappointed. And I think there are reasons for that. You know, the third book, I think, that the guides dictated through me was called The Book of Knowing and Worth. And they talked about this sort of collective belief we have, and we've gotten, you know, foisted on by religion, which is that we're basically sinful and not worthy, which is not true. You know, they're anxious. They're always saying, you're claiming your inheritance here. This is your true inheritance. You know, it's yours to claim, but we don't know that we're allowed. And also, sometimes people think you're not going to have any fun if you do this, or you're not going to get what you want. And that's usually what you think you want. The guides are saying,
let me just clear that up for anybody who thinks you're not going to have fun. I'm having a lot of fun. All the fun is still on the table. I had that same fear. Remember, we could rewind the tape 3 years ago, and I'd be like, but I'm worried I won't be as much fun. Maybe I won't, you know, maybe sex won't be as much fun, and maybe playing basketball won't be as much fun. Oh, it's more fun. The more that I'm able to go to the upper room, the more fun it is. Basketball and sex are more fun in the upper room. Like, straight up, I can testify like a inspired Baptist preacher, like, it is more fun up in the upper room. It is for sure.
You're present for it. And also, I suspect what begins to happen is that the innate holiness, for lack of a better word, of all of these things becomes part of your experience. I mean, now the guides are teaching and they're really getting into this now, is that the senses are amplified and changed, and where we've been operating at a very, very limited capacity. Now, plant medicine hasn't been part of my journey, and I'm fascinated by it. It's just not been part of my journey, but I understand that people, when they are working with the guide stuff, often have experience that's comparable. You know, they're seeing the stuff, they're seeing the energy, they're feeling it, and I'm very happy for that. But I think that we have this innate ability to, I'll just call it, see God. But seeing God isn't some guy in a cloud. It's everything experienced. You know, I don't do that. You know, it's funny because I take the dictation for these things. I'm not always the best student, but I'm better than I used to be by a lot. But I, you know, I just was sitting outside today and I started, you know, basically blessing the tree, this big tree in my yard that I just take for granted. And I felt the energy of the tree just pouring back at me. And I'm like, this is what they're talking about. And the guys have always said, what you bless blesses you in return. And they say what a blessing is the claiming of the inherent divine. They always say inherent divine where it has been denied. You're seeing the divine that must be there in the fabric of all manifestation, like it or not, agree with it or not. That doesn't mean you're blessing somebody's poor conduct or hard acts, but you perhaps are seeing the inherent divine in that human being where he or she has most denied it and then is enacting that denial, which changes people. You know, that's real.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think actually you can bless an act made in separation, but you don't excuse it necessarily.
Exactly,
you
don't. You're not condoning it, but you're
not condoning it. Condoning is the right word. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not condoning it. You're claiming the presence of the divine where it's been denied. I mean, they're really simple teachings. The guides say, "What you damn, damns you back.
What you bless, you know? Blesses you back."
And what you bless. But the funny thing is, you can feel it.
Yeah, I absolutely.
Mean, you can feel the energy come back. The guides, when they first started teaching that, used to call it the echo. And they'd have all their students go outside, stand like 20 feet apart and claim the inherent divine in the body of the partner 20 feet away. And the energy field of the partner would just sort of, it was like a bell ringing. You just feel the peals of energy or the waves of energy coming. And I think these things are available to us far more than we know. And part of the reason we don't walk around experiencing them is that we haven't been told we're allowed to, or that we're not supposed to, or you can't. Or there's something to be fearful of. I mean, perhaps for many people, you know, plant medicine is opening up the roof that was in limitation and allowing other things. You know, for me, it's been this strange work, which I still don't know how it happened for me.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. I have a couple queries that are not exactly on the same thread, but I want to talk about them because I was with, I was with my best friend. He was playing a football game and everything was lined up. He'd poured his heart into it. He's out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, my friend is Aaron Rodgers. He's a quarterback for the New York Jets. And he was out there and it was about to be it was a heroic story that was laid out. Mm-hmm. And fourth play of the game, he gets an Achilles rupture, which is a very serious injury. Mm-hmm. And it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. And when I was talking to him, you know, there was, in my idea, it was like, well, you know, there's a couple ways to look at this. One, this is divine providence and we just don't know it yet. And part of that is our choice to make sure that it's divine providence by the actions that we take following it. Mm-hmm. Another part is this could be some, you know, snake bite from what I believe that there are forces that are in resistance to, you know, to us. It could have been a snake bite of a certain sort, or it could have just been maybe there's just chaos built into and randomness, chaos and randomness. So my real question is not necessarily about divine providence or the dark force. We've covered that. Yeah. But my question is like, what is the play of chaos and randomness in our world?
I'm going to go to them with this because I'm, you know, I'm confused by this at a personal level. You know, I live on Maui and, you know, there was devastation, you know, on this island recently. Let me just see what they want to say. And if they want to take this, we would like to. They're saying we would like to. Well, chaos is an adjective, a way of describing the things you can't, a way of describing the things that you cannot understand. Finally, there is divine order. Finally, there is divine order. Indeed, things happen that would not be chosen, perhaps there are accidents, and perhaps there are accidents or things that are understood later, or under things that are understood later as having meaning that are incomprehensible, the time they occurred, at the time that they occurred. You're looking at your lives in very small ways. You're looking at your lives in very small ways, not in a continuum of life as a whole, but in the immediacy of your personal circumstances, of your personal circumstances. Now, when one is injured, maybe there may be varying reasons for an injury. For an injury, the one driving the car may have been driving well and hit from behind. The one hit from behind may indeed be injured. You can look at this chaotic, or finally we suggest as an opportunity for something new to be comprehended and to be comprehended or understood. The reliability of your temporary reality as you understand it, is being accosted these days. What you thought would be there tomorrow is not there tomorrow. The person you thought you loved who would not leave, may be going elsewhere. Institutions are failing. Structures are falling. There is chaos as part of the change that you are incurring when you pull back enough and bear witness to a life, you will understand meaning. You may not like the meaning. We are not saying people deserve or choose what they get. If there is calamity, somebody leaves a match in the ground, the house may burn. Somebody doesn't forget to turn off the oven. There will be a problem. These things can be seen as accidents. Some of them are. They can be seen as nefarious. Perhaps some of them are. If the one driving the car was intending to hit the person before them, you may call that evil or an aggressive act. You would not be wrong. But finally we suggest at the end of a lifetime, you have comprehension about what real meaning is, what the opportunity was, how the soul was engaging in an event, and what benefit there might be from re-seeing it now. It is very hard to perceive eternity when you're focused on what happened yesterday, when you are focused on what happened yesterday, what you think tomorrow should be, or what you think tomorrow should be. But you do know that every moment is eternity, that every moment is eternity in time itself, and time itself is how you abdicate, your soul's authority to a situation, period, in the same period.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful wisdom there. It's like, it's only chaos from our perspective, but from the perspective of the eternal, there is a divine order that can be seen. There's another purview that we may never get access to. You know, we may not in our current embodied existence, but that makes a lot of sense.
I didn't know Ram Dass, I'm part of the satsang, that was developed at his house. And they're lovely people and they're my friends. And some of the kids who were caregiving Ram Dass became my good friends and would tell me stories, and a lot of it was really about how he grew after the stroke and how his spiritual teachings became embodied for him at a personal level, after he lost some of the ability of his body and speech, which I found extraordinary. I'm not there, I may never be there, but I think how we can opportunize everything as as something to be learned from or changed with, I think is crucial to our not claiming victimhood as identity. There are times when people are victimized. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, but I am saying that when that becomes one's identity, one will accrue more and more and more evidence of the same. And that's how we work.
This reminds me of a Toltec teaching that I first encountered from Carlos Castaneda, but has been, reified through and reinforced through Don Miguel Ruiz and some of the other Toltec masters is, for the ordinary person, everything is a blessing or a curse. Yeah. You're either, but for the Nagual or for the master or for the warrior, they use warrior Nagual. Nagual is kind of a master for them. There are only challenges. For the Nagual, there are only challenges, and those are opportunity, and every challenge is an opportunity. And then there's an opportunity that arises and a whole path that develops of opportunity on the other side of that. And that's that seems to be just a very sound principle to have, is to not say, you know, that this thing that happened is bad or good because you don't know yet.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, well, we're going to find out. And through my act of will, through my act of intent, which is another deep Toltec teaching, through my act of intent, I'm going to make sure that this has a deep and powerful meaning. You know, Ram Dass made the choice when he couldn't speak because of his aphasia. He's like, well, now I'm going to live more in my heart. You know, and that was a choice to give that the meaning. And that's mm-hmm. what you're referring to, is that there's always the choice. No matter what happens, there's the choice of how we respond to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we're in an interesting time as well in the collective. And this is, again, another one of these questions that I've been eager to see if the guides wanted to weigh in on. There's been a massive movement towards disclosure of what is now called unidentified anomalous phenomena, UAPs. Used to be called UFOs, now it's called UAPs. And there's been a lot of testimony from different people in different naval sources, military sources, intelligence sources, who've now, because the Whistleblower Act has been lifted, they've been free to actually testify that they have whole hosts of unidentified anomalous phenomena. They actually have recovered crafts. This is the testimony, recovered crafts and what they say are biologics. And we're now at this time where this is becoming more generally accepted and seems to be escalating, that we're actually starting to see ourselves and our lives as connected to, call it, the Galactic Federation or the Star Nations or other beings beyond the planet. And it seems like this is somehow playing some role in this time of transition that we're in right now. It seems it would be a hell of a coincidence that this is all coming out also at this deep time of transition. Mm-hmm. So just curious to see if the guides, which are an anomalous phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Melchizedek is itself an anomalous phenomenon. It doesn't show up in crafts all the time. Maybe it does sometimes. I don't know. But what's their, do they have any guidance? Have they talked about this phenomenon that's kind of happening?
Not so much, really. I mean, I think, you know, surprisingly not in some ways, but at the same time, it feels like a benevolent nod to what's happening. Like, of course, is what I would suggest. That would be the response they've had. They rarely bring it up. The very first time I did a book signing at the old Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, there were like five people there. And I was reading a book, and somebody raised their hand in the second row, and they said to me, like, this sounds like those evil aliens and the Galactic. What do the guides say about the evil aliens? And the guides hadn't been saying anything, and they piped right in and said, isn't it bad enough that you can't get along here? You have to vilify the rest of the universe. That was their response. And then they shut up. And I thought, well, that's a good way to address it. So let me see if they want to say anything. The idea that there is life elsewhere, the idea that there is life elsewhere is no surprise. How you attend to it, and how gracefully you can attend to it, will be the surprise. In fact, you've been prepared for this. In fact, you have been prepared for this for many, many years, the idea of life, resembling you, or even resembling form, which need not be form, but maybe an idea, form that you utilize is so present now in the energy field of the planet, that you are aligning to the possibilities, things are not what you think, that things are not what you think or what you should have them be or what you should have them be through prior conceit. What is occurring now is a reestablishment of humanity as species. You have forgotten species. You think in terms of race or religion, our countrymen, you do not think of species. And until you understand that you are one, you'll be contending malice. You will be contending with malice, creating, in other words, feud and fire that you must decide means something other than the intent behind it, You want a war, you can war. If you want a war, you can war. When you know you're warring with your brother, you will not war, period.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think this is the time to start. I see us, the necessity for us to come together as representatives of planet Earth, the species of humans representing, mm-hmm. you know, representing Gaia Sophia, this planet's highest manifestation of life so far. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting moment that I think has a lot more potential beauty to it than fear. But of course people may take it as a fearful thing, but I really think that's the wrong way to look at it.
I think if people are looking for somebody to hate, you can find somebody, and you can find it in any form. You know, if you want that, you can find that. I had a mentor years ago. She was a wonderful old time medium. And she said to me that humanity's progress is actually being monitored by other systems, because mm-hmm. everything is trying to move forward and we're holding it back. You know, our being stuck in the mud and stuck in our ways is actually preventing everything from going forward. Yeah. And I understand that that's what's happening now. And I think it's a positive. I really do.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Now, here's another thing that's, you know, kind of becoming very present. And this is the proliferation of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And of course, people are approaching this in similar ways. Some people with extreme fear, some people with mm-hmm. extreme excitement, but yeah. it is undoubtedly a disruptive force. So have the guides weighed in on this artificial intelligence kind of topic that's impending?
Only once. And it was a number of years ago, and it was in a podcast with Duncan Trussell, actually.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
We need to be, and he asked the guides. I barely knew what it was. I mean, you know, I'm a, you know. But the guides said, you know, I think the question was, will we be overtaken? And they said, no, because artificial intelligence does not love. Mm. And that's going to be what, I guess, saves us. I'd have to go back and listen to the interview. But I was surprised that they said that. And at the time, it made sense. And I'm sure they said it better than I just did. What I hear is it's how you choose to work with it. It's how you choose to address the opportunity. The faction that will try to use it for rule will try. I hear, and it will not succeed. And it cannot, finally. And this has to do, and they've been speaking about this more in the last couple of years than ever, and I don't know what I think of it. Because I was basically hearing humanity will not allow it. But they talk about humanity at times as almost having a collective soul, the species having a soul mind. And they said, you know, you're not, you know, you've come to a realization that if you keep going the way you're going, you're going to blow yourselves up. And you're not going to allow that finally. You know that. Mm-hmm. And that's why everybody's sort of moving away and moving forward towards this new ideal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I want to, so the guides, mm-hmm. Melchizedek, you know, is that still the preferred name that they like to be used? They don't really like names very much, it seems like.
I don't think they care. I mean, they're called the guides because my ex used to say, ask the guides this, ask the guides that. They didn't object, so they landed with it. I was just speaking at a conference that Paul and the guides, I thought, well, that's funny. Everybody else, you know, the title of who they channel. They've said, you know, if you wish to call us something, you can call us Melchizedek. But they've also said, and I prefer this one, they said, we are who you become when you know who you are. And uh-huh. at times they've called themselves the true self. And that's Christ. That's the Christ consciousness, the divine self or the true self. And right. I understand this all as a level of consciousness. You know, yep. there's one that I've seen, and I've seen him a few times, and he's remarkable to see. And, you know, for the most part, my experience is auditory or clairaudience. You know, it's like something that pushes all the other thoughts away. When I'm speaking with you, I'm still present. When I'm channeling a book, I'm far more receded. You know, I'm right really into the back seat and I stay there until the lecture is over. They're saying, well, they said Melchizedek is fine. So I guess
Well, I'm curious, and this wasn't even, I have a second question, but I'm mm-hmm. interested in this. There are different slight tones of dictation, yeah. words, like one of the guides, one in particular expression of the guides, which is a collective voice, uses the words "my dears" or something like that. It's like a, it's a very kind of like affectionate term. Yeah. And then you said you've also seen you know, you've seen one of them, so they can almost merge as a collective consciousness, but then also split and have, you know, unique identities. If you were to ask that one that you see that appears as separate, but also connected, because they're deeply connected with the field, of course, do you have a name? You know, if you were to ask that one, do you have a name? Would there be a separate name than Melchizedek? Like, the, oh, no, I am so-and-so.
Say Melchizedek is the title and the origin of the teaching of the teaching, period, period. This is Melchizedek as espoused through these teachings, through these teachings. We are as the priesthood. We are as the priesthood and the being you know of as well. And the being you know of as a Melchizedek is too large to be brought through, to be brought through fully in channel. So it's caught. So it's caught in the discussion, as it can be led, In other words, the vibration of the teaching, is Melchizedek, and Melchizedek as priesthood, and Melchizedek as priesthood. The two work concurrently. Say this. So the one that I saw, and I'll just, you know, because I don't, you know, I was getting hypnotized by somebody and I thought it was going to be something other. And then halfway through the session, he said, now your guide's going to come. And I'm going, oh, that's not going to happen. And he did. And and I've seen him three times and always a version of the same. But he has pale blue eyes. When I've been told my eyes often turn pale blue when they're really through full blast. And the hat that he was wearing was almost like a, like we'd seen like in Greek or Greek Orthodoxy. It was very tall and it had a bit of a pancake at the top, you know, something at the top, and a robe and a long, long beard. But he was holding a scepter, and the scepter was had gold embossed hieroglyphics on it. Wow. And he was sitting beside me, and I heard, and it was all telepathic, and he said, this is what we use to attune people. And I had recently been channeling and walking around with my hands like this, not knowing what I was doing. He was explaining what was going on. I was holding the scepter. He was holding the scepter. And I was once at a conference at Esalen with some anthropologist who was saying, how do you know it's not you? How do you know? And I'm going, well, I guess I don't. I just know that I can't close my eyes and dictate. I don't know how many books there were at that time that don't need any editing. Because none of the books are edited, they're just transcriptions.
Right.
And then I went to this other meditation that this woman was running because I was going to be a nice participant and go to the other person's meditation. And I'm feeling crappy about this conversation with the anthropologist. And this woman is doing this endless guided visualization. Now you're walking down a hill and there's a ravine and there's a stream and you're going, get me out of this thing. And finally, I'm at the bottom of this hill, you know, the bottom in this gulch. And this woman says, and now your guide is going to come through. And I'm going, yeah, right. And I saw the same guide that I saw with a big hat and a big beard tumbling down the hill, holding two, whatever that looked like, the Torah or something, these two huge scrolls barreling down the hill. And he said to me, stop trying to tell people who you are, you don't know. And he went right back up the hill. And I thought that was great. Or stop trying to explain to people, because I'd been trying to explain the work to somebody who wasn't going to go there. Yeah. And I loved that one. That felt great. Yeah. And he was fun. And there was joy. And other times I've seen him in a library. Huge vast library.
That's beautiful. I've started to work with sacred objects in my own practice as well to understand that these objects may have a physical representation, but I don't use them in the physical. I use them in the extra dimensional realms beyond. And so this scepter of attunement, you could call it, is like one of your sacred objects that you use, and you find yourself holding it. And it's been a powerful tool in my own, for my own psychonautic journey. So it's cool to hear you say that, that these sacred objects go all the way up and all the way down. But ultimately my question of for Melchizedek and potentially your specific guide and whoever one, you know, wanted to speak on it is what I sense is that, you know, and many of them have taken bodies before, and it's possible that they could take bodies again, presumably. And if they were to take bodies again, what I'm curious about is, you know, one of the things that I see transforming is the nature of relationship itself. And relationship speaking romantically, which is the typical dyadic monogamous relationship container, and but also the relationship amongst what you could call tribe, like your soul pod or your crew. And I see what I see is a future reality where things are shared amongst those who you trust and resonate and vibrate with in a much different way. And I guess my curious question is if these beings were to come in, you know, and they would they look around and go like, oh, no, we gotta reimagine some of these structures of relationship that kind of abide not in the myth of separation. Cause you talk about that a little bit in this, like if I will become the one who chooses what he gets at the cost of another's desires. In other words, the belief that you will be controlled by another's love or desire for you is a way to prove separation. So it feels like they're pointing towards a new evolution in the future of relationship.
I get that that's accurate. The idea of who you are separate reinforces separation. Even if you bond with another, you decide yourselves as separate. You decide yourselves as separate. We are separate from the one next to us. We are separate from the ones next to us. You can have intimacy. You can have intimacy and deep knowing and sharing without the systems, that would replicate separation, What does this look like? He asked. It looks like love. It looks like love without the requirement of contract, or sanctification, from an institution, period.
Yeah, that's also, you know, it's the complication of greater contact with the upper room version of myself. It's like, oh, contracts that define separation. Like my soul being is like, it's fine. Do what you want. Whatever you want is cool. Like there's no force or no pressure, but it's like, it's wearing a sweater that it doesn't really like to wear. It's like, I'll wear it, you know, but I don't like this Christmas sweater. You know, I'm Jewish or whatever. It's like, I'll wear it, but you know, it's not like it doesn't exactly suit the essence that I'm certainly feeling.
You know, I don't know what I think. They don't knock marriage as an institution. They're all for commitment. I think where they seem to have some concern is the idea of the contracts that they say are primarily financially based and fear based. You know, if you're my partner, you're not going to have sex with somebody else. If you're my partner, you know, all of the agreements that might be implicit. Now, those are things that people can choose. You can choose those things, but if they're not chosen in integrity, I don't know if they're necessarily going to last or are going to be healthy.
If they're chosen in fear, they're bound with fear.
Exactly right.
And so then as you go to reclaim yourself as one outside of fear, those things have to be reknown and can be rechosen out of love and out of devotion, then reknown in a new way. But it seems like if fear was the formation of the contract needs to be re-known in a new way. And that seems to be the way that it's understanding. And it seems as the collective transforms, and I've been trying all different forms and ways and trying all of the different ways, but it seems like it's not only in romantic partnerships, but it's also in friendships. Yeah. The guidance that keeps coming is merge the kingdoms. You know, if I have powerful allies, it's like, why do you have a bank account and a house that's not their bank account and house when you trust them with your life? Like you would literally go stand with them. And again, we're not trying to get into battles, but using this as a metaphor, you would stand with them on any battle, face any storm. You know, if you would go to the end of the earth, the end of infinity with this person, then why not merge the kingdoms, trust each other, you know, develop a new level of connection amongst brothers, amongst sisters, amongst the chosen, what in the Hawaiian word is ohana, your chosen family, you know, and that can include lovers, doesn't require lovers, but includes that as well. But it's this kind of, it's this collapse of separation as we understand relationship agreement between friends and lovers.
I mean, I'm with you. I think if we begin to move towards a basis of community as something that's to be aspired to, I think that that's an extraordinary thing. And I think we're probably going to have to. You know, you know, I was isolated in my life in many ways. You know, I was a college teacher. I did my thing. I lived in Manhattan. I had my apartment. And since I moved to Maui, I really began to learn about community because I was welcomed into one. And it's been life-changing for me, you know, what happens. And everything that you're describing is just love. It's what you do when you love somebody, you know, and when, you're not frightened of losing what you have, you know. The idea that it takes something from us to care for somebody else, I think, is something that we need to look at carefully individually. It's not always the case.
Right, right. There's another quote that I thought was really powerful from the book. The war within the self, which is born in the denial of the divine, is the basis of every war, every battle, and every act of violence that has ever occurred on this plane. And is there any guidance for, you know, how, when someone really knows they're at war in themselves, when the toggling, because we talk about toggling from the upper room down to the lower room, the personality, small self structure to the other room, and it feels like both of those things are at war. Like, how does somebody practically help resolve that war?
I hear forgiveness. That's the only key, which is really acceptance, forgiveness, and acceptance work hand in hand. The battle within the self is not remedied by seeking to distort or separate the self from the aspect of self, from the aspect of self that is so challenging. Nothing will be healed, and nothing will be healed until it is first accepted, or at least seen and recognized as of God, and then recognized as of God, period. And they're saying period.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. There's one, you know, one more thing I want to touch on too, which is the power of presence and being without action and doing is under-indexed in its importance. And this is not something new in the Book of Innocence. This is something that's always been there. But I was just, you know, hoping for you and if guides want to come in, but just talk about how, you know, actually we over-index the importance of doing and under-index the importance of presence and being, and how someone being attuned to a higher vibrational field is itself an action that claims the higher field. And so I think helping people understand that it's not always about what you do. So what if you post and only, you know, 50 people see it? It doesn't make that less important, but if you're holding a sense of presence, that may be actually more important than someone posting to 50 million people, but from a lower vibration, you know? So it's like kind of reimagining for those people who are able to hold that higher state of presence and being and reifying the value of that action.
You know, I thought that was going to be the title of the Book of Innocence, was Presence and Being, because they kept going back and back and back to that. And then they called it something entirely differently. And I go, boy, this is going to be strange. I don't know what this is going to mean. In their earlier books, they bring through this attunement. I know who I am in truth. I know what I am in truth. I know how I serve in truth. And the guides say how one serves is how one is most fully expressed as the true self. Now, people in our culture tend to think that that's what one does for a living or how one shows up, you know, ready to work. And I think those can be ways that we express, but I don't think it's what they're necessarily talking about. They're talking about moving to a level of alignment with your own knowing, or the knowing of who you are. To know is to realize. And the guides have said the true self knows and the small self thinks. And the guides have also said that once one knows, when you truly know, you may be called to act from that place. Mm-hmm. So if I truly know something, I'm actually probably going to be impelled to act upon that knowing in some way. But I don't think that we get to the action without the knowing. Other than that, we're just doing the best we can, which is based on what we know. And all we know is what we've known prior. You know, the personality self, they say, is entirely constructed through historical data. You know, what we think it means to be a man or a woman or a teacher or this or that in the times that we're born in, through cultural observance, and how our families raised us and what our teachers said, all those things. When the guides claim, I am free, they're talking about becoming free of that level of entrainment or indoctrination in some ways to what we've expected, which I think, operates as a ceiling that we're moving past. And the ceiling is, you know, to the upper room. I am free, mm-hmm. I am free, I am free. I am in the upper room, which is the aspect of you that already abides there. People think that this is someplace you take a vacation at, but the guides say the monad or the divine self, the God within you, already expresses at that level of vibration and tone. And what you're doing in this teaching is transposing the music of the rest of you to play up there with the monad. And that is presence and being. You know, the work of your hands, I don't think this is done through hard effort. I think there are things that are effortful, but I don't think the work of the guides is effortful in that way. It's more about agreement. And in some ways, I suspect more about allowance and surrender, allowing the divine within you to call itself forward. Because you can't make God be God. God already is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would love to open up... open up the space for, you know, in the guide's divine intelligence for an attunement or any other transmission or message that could serve the people listening to this show here.
All right, let me see. Let me just step out to address several things. They're saying we would like to address several things. First and foremost is identity. First and foremost is identity, the belief, or the belief that you are separate, the aspect who knows it is. The aspect of you who knows who it is, knows itself, and knows itself in union always, and so always, and so will always be in union or consciousness. You don't conjure this, you align to it, you align to it, the attunements we offer. The attunements we offer reclaim you at a level of tone, each and every one, to align to you, to your highest, expression, underline the word expression, It's how you demonstrate. It is how you demonstrate or facilitate the monad come as you, or the divine come as you, It's expression. Its expression is what is being claimed here, not the better idea of you, or the more beneficial one, the true one, the aspect of you that truly knows, You may say these words after we speak them if you wish. I know who I am in truth. I know what I am in truth. I know how I serve in truth. I am free, I am free, I am free. I am in the upper room. I have come. Behold, I make all things new. It will be so. God is. The experience of the teachings culminating in God is, which is expression, can now be understood. Is aligning to what is always true. You don't make God God. You don't make God God. You align to the source of all things. Come as all things. You must understand that the source of all things is present. And that the denial of the divine, which is the disfiguring of reality through the lens of separation, can be reclaimed. The attunements align your source. And in benefit ways, and in beneficial ways, the truth of your being, that indeed has come, will support the reclamation, of the manifest world, That's claim. That is the claim. Behold, I make all things new. It will be so. The activation of the prior claim. Come into form as all things, and that is the final claim. God is. You're saying
I could feel a beautiful lifting from that transmission, and it also points to a practicum, and the practicum is to use that, you know, and there's many of them that come in all of the teachings in your books, but that particular one seems to be, it seems to have built over the years in the many books, these 11 books, and it's now culminating in that particular sequence. And it's of all of the attunements, it's the most powerful because it's the, it's taken, it's gone the farthest. And not to try and rank the attunements, but ultimately it was just a beautiful experience for me to experience that and feel that in my own body and just remind myself if I find myself, you know, rummaging around in the basement whether, and then just in a desire through my own will and choice to start to elevate myself, to use something like those attunements to bring myself back into the acknowledgement of who I really am.
They're there. You know, the guides describe them at different times as like notes on a piano. And when all the notes are played in unison, you have a chord. And to be in a chord, or A-C-C-O-R-D, they say, or A-C-H-O-R-D, is to move into the level of alignment of the claim. And this seems to culminate in the claim God is. And I think they've taken us through them in sequence because we can only hold so much at a certain time. You bring too much light into a room where somebody's been sitting in the dark, they're going to run or they'll blow their fuses. You know, too much electricity in the bulb, you go bang. But I think we're being prepared for this in gradation. And the attunements people can work with on their own as they wish. It's there. They say it's language encoded with vibration. It's always there.
Yeah. Paul, I love you, man.
Love you
I really
too.
Do. Yeah, you've been a great friend and ally for me, for those that I love, and of course for the world. And it's just always a delight and pleasure to see your face. And hopefully we'll get to see each other in person again at some point along the path. I'm sure we will. And I look forward to these books keep coming. So I look forward to getting my advanced copy of the next one as well, because I'm right there riding along with the teachings and, you know, charting my own path of how I'm able to align with them in the best way possible.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you so much to everybody tuning in. The book is The Book of Innocence, and it will be available everywhere books are sold. And I highly recommend the audiobook version too, because when Paul's reading it, it's particularly powerful. He also doesn't, he just reads the text. He doesn't actually have to whisper and repeat. Yeah. So it's a very smooth process in the audiobooks. So highly recommend the audiobooks. They're fantastic. Yeah. All right. So much love, Paul. So much love, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this show, everyone. Make sure you check out Paul Selig's impressive body of work. Well, the guide's impressive body of work that comes through Paul. I love you guys, and I'll see you next week.